Set your course for the Huff
Takes Podcast.
Welcome to Huff Takes. I'm Eric Geller.
I'm Grace Seegers.
And I'm Haley Bird-Wilt.
And we're here to talk about the final four episodes of Andor Season 1. Those would be Episode 9, Nobody's Listening, Episode 10, One Way Out, Episode 11, Daughter of Ferrix, and Episode 12, Rick's Road. Now, obviously, we here at Hot Takes are going to do more episodes on Andor as a whole and different aspects of the show, but this episode is just going to be about that final third of the season. So just to catch everybody up, in these episodes, we see Cassian begin to develop his rebel instincts as he inspires a prison revolt with Andy Serkis as Kino Loy going through an incredible journey. We see Dedra Miro remind us that, yep, she's a fascist, as Cyril pines to get back into the action. We see Mon Mothma make some brutal, cold-hearted choices to protect her role in the rebellion. We see Luthen go toe-to-toe with Saw Gerrera again and later reveal the depth of his sacrifice. And finally, we see Cassian listen to Nemec and Marva and take Luthen up on his offer to, as he put it, fight these bastards for real. So let's get into this. I've obviously tweeted a lot about how I thought these episodes were an incredible tour de force of, you know, dialogue and acting and political storytelling, really sort of capping off a season that has redefined what Star Wars can be. But I want to hear what my co-hosts think about these last four episodes overall before we get into kind of the nitty-gritty of them. Grace, overall, what did you make of this final third of the season?
I mean, it was just phenomenal. And I know we had talked in our previous two episodes covering the first two thirds of the show. Each little recap has been just a glowing review from me. But I think especially this final third, the previous two thirds of the show were excellent, but the prison break and the final episode leading to the rebellion on Ferrix, the insurrection on Ferrix, and all the little moments in between, like Luthen's speech and just understanding the nuances of everything that was going on. It was just really freaking good. And I cannot remember the last time that my expectations were so high for a Star Wars product, and then those expectations were exceeded. It is just a completely new feeling for me to have that happen.
I very much agree on all of those fronts. I think what just sets it apart so much is like how informed it is and how intentional it is. Like the writing is just incredible. I will say, because I'm sure I'll forget to say it later, so I'm just going to say it now. I think what's going to stick with me most from the whole series is the prison camp episodes. And on it, everybody said the prison break episode was like the best, but honestly, I think the one before it was like the best episode in Andor, because in that episode you have so much like tension and like mystery, and prisoners are freaking out, and you get to see that transformation where Kino really realizes like the system is not going to help him. And it just very clearly depicts a lot of human rights abuses that are happening today. And I think it's important to see that kind of thing on screen. So when I think of Andor in the future, I'm sure I will mostly remember that performance of Kino and sort of how he was radicalized.
Never more than 12.
It's the best line.
So good.
Yeah, it's this great continuation of bringing these real-world political issues to the forefront, but not doing it in a ham-fisted way, really making it organic, part of a natural Star Wars story. And so let's talk about our main character, Cassian, and what he goes through in these episodes, starting with that prison experience. It struck me that we're really watching somebody develop a revolutionary conscience. I mean, he's not yet at the point where he's really interested in sacrificing his life for others, but he is recognizing that if he wants to preserve his own life and ensure a future for himself, he's going to have to rise up. And you see him, you know, that first episode when he's at the prison, which we talked about last time, he's very meek, he's quiet, he's still kind of disoriented, trying to figure everything out. when you start episode 9, boom, he is making jokes with the group. He's kind of leading them through the process of making that widget. Like, he has acclimated to the setting, but he has not lost his drive to get out of there, which is obviously very different from Kino's experience of acclimating, where he realizes there's a benefit to dropping that sort of that passion to escape or to get out. And I think it's so cool to see him. He's not even trying at this point, but he's just, without trying, giving off that energy, that spark that will push other people to rise up. You want to talk a little bit about how we see him, again, subconsciously start to inspire others?
I think it's so fun to watch his journey in the prison episodes because, much like everything else in this show, it just feels like a very natural development. But to see him, he's really beginning to assert that sort of latent sense of leadership and this feeling that he has of wanting to be a part of the community. I think you see that in the flashbacks in Canary when he was a kid, and you see that as well in how he's part of the community in Ferrix, and now he is becoming part of the community in the prison, and he begins to really care about the people on Narkeena 5 just like he cares about the people of his home. And it's really interesting to see his sort of revolutionary instincts not just be driven by a sense of self-preservation, I think, but also by his sense of community. And we see that in the episode Haley was talking about and in Narkeena 5 and just on Ferrix generally. And I think it's very natural to see that progression.
And one thing I appreciate about the episodes where you sort of see Cassian start to like ask questions about how the prison camp is being run and how they could escape is that he's bringing with him just like a background knowledge of how oppression works. And so when he's in the cell talking to Kino and he's like, they're not listening to us. Like they're like, they don't think we're going to do anything. Like, we're beneath them. They like, I found that scene really impactful. And I think that was also like, it wasn't what put Kino over the top, but to hear that perspective, like you don't really think of that when you're like in the day-to-day drudgery of being oppressed, but like having that outside perspective come in and be like, they're not listening to everything you do. Like there's room to be thinking about how you can get out. And so I appreciated those scenes. I thought that was really just well-written.
Yeah, I'm so glad you brought that up. I mean, he's got this great line. I think it's the beginning of episode 10 where he says, power doesn't panic. Basically saying they're not as strong as you think they are, right? True control means not, you know, wildly overreacting to a threatening situation, right? That's the definition of control, is when you don't have to lash out like that. We see this later on Ferrix, of course, but like he has that understanding of how the Empire works. But again, he's not consciously, deliberately planning some sort of inspiring, rousing movement here. This is just, he knows these things and he's saying them because they're true and they're having this effect on the people around him, but it is not yet this deliberate process of trying to inspire others the way that, you know, Leia gives all the speeches in the original trilogy, where it's very calculated, it's very planned out. Here, this is just a guy who's been through it all and he's just imparting his wisdom in a very natural, conversational way, and it turns people around him into believers in this cause that he himself is only just starting to wake up to. And of course, we see in that the prison break episode itself, it's really, as you said, it's his impetus that gets Kino Loy to make the speeches, to push, to use his influence and authority to start the prison break. And Tony Gilroy basically said, he's actually said this in several interviews, that that's a mark of leadership. It's not necessarily being the one at the front. It's being able to convince somebody else to be the one at the front, recognizing that they're a better messenger, and that if you can just point them in the right direction, they have the tools they need to be there, that person, to stand up and be that person. So I thought that was another great way of showing that he is developing this revolutionary consciousness, even if it doesn't look the same as it will in Rogue One.
This is a slight tangent, but can we just talk for a minute about how many absolutely killer lines there were? Just insane dialogue that will be sticking with me for a very long time, like the power doesn't panic, like Luthen's whole speech. I mean, his whole speech, but especially, like, I burned my life to make a sunrise that I know I'll never see. And, like, the manifesto, Nemec's manifesto, and the line that has been driving me absolutely insane. I have not known peace since I heard this line when the last episode of Andor came out, said by Brasso, quoting Marva, tell him I love him more than anything he can ever do wrong. Like, how am I supposed to move on from that? How am I supposed to live my life normally after hearing that line? Like, I'm just going absolutely insane over some of these lines that are just going to live rent-free in my head forever. It's too good.
It's pretty interesting to have quality writing in Star Wars for a change. Like, you know, not to say that, like, we haven't had quality stories, but specifically, like, quality writing where the actual dialogue sticks with you as it would with any show, whether it was Star Wars or not Star Wars. Pretty weird to be in that situation where we have people quoting lines like that. But, you know, it's a good kind of weird to me. So I'm happy with it, and all praise to Tony there. So we do see, as Cassian gets out of the prison, and he moves into, I think, a more defiant posture and a more kind of, he's more ready to actually step into the shoes of, like, a rebel soldier, essentially, because he gets to Ferrix. He hears, you know, Marva gives her speech, and he rescues Bix, and he makes his way to Luthen at the end of the season. And, you know, I think it was pretty obvious from the beginning that season one was going to be the story of this guy, you know, building up to the point of wanting to participate. And then the next season was him actually participating. But still, the fact that we knew that was coming, it was just handled so well. It was authentic. It was organic. You don't watch it with the sensation that they're moving a chess piece from A to B. It feels like a natural progression of what a human being would do and how they would start to think if they were in these situations, most of which are not in their control, right? I mean, you know, everything that he sets in motion from that first episode, a lot of that is done to him. It's situations that he finds himself in, and he reacts in a very natural way. And you can totally understand how a person like him would wind up there at the end of the season at Luthen's doorstep saying, look, I'm ready to fight for this movement. And if you don't want me, you're going to have to kill me, because otherwise I don't really have anything else left to do. I know I need to hit back at them for what they've done to me and to my community. And it's such a brilliant scene. And of course it ends, you know, with Luthen kind of giving that smile of, like, I'm getting everything I want. And we know where that's, you know, kind of setting the stage for season two there. But do you have any thoughts on just how the events on Ferrix, and again, he's listened to Nemec's manifesto and all that, transforms him, gives him that final push into being ready to actually start to be the Cassian Andor that we know?
I just, before we get to that, can we, like, is it truly only going to be a two-season show? Because we're talking about, like, the arc of the seasons, and I just wish it was more. It shouldn't only be two.
Yeah, they were going to do a season per year, but then Tony Gilroy said, we realized that, you know, we would be 85 by the time this was done, because it's taken them so long to do one season. And, you know, some of that is, like, initial startup work, but, like, the rest of it is just plotting and filming and all the other stuff, post-production. So, yeah, they decided they'll just consolidate it down. They're going to have the same number of episodes in season two, but it's going to be three episodes per year. So 4 years over 12 episodes, leading right into Rogue One. I think he actually said that the end, he's like, we're going to lead right into him, like, getting on the ship to go to the planet where he's in Rogue, at the beginning of Rogue One. So, like, they are very precisely timing it to where they're going to end up, but it's only going to be one more season.
Ugh. That's so sad. I need it. I need more.
I hope they change their mind, because, like, this one, this is the only opportunity to tell this story. Like, he dies at the end. We know what happens to him. So, I don't know. I wish they would reconsider that. Especially because I liked the pacing of this first season. And it sounds like if it's three episodes per year, like, yeah, there's not as many opportunities to tell sort of in-depth storylines like we got to see. But
yeah, well,
I'm not in charge.
We'll definitely get to that. We're going to have probably more episodes looking ahead to the future of Andor. Can we talk about Mon Mothma, though? I'm sorry, but can we talk about Mon Mothma in these episodes? Because if you thought that she was interesting in the first eight episodes of the season, they do some incredible stuff with her in these episodes. The first thing I want to talk about is we see a lot more vulnerability from her. So we see her, you know, there's these scenes with Vel where she's like, we're in over our heads. Like, I don't really know what we're doing here. And Vel has to sort of put her back on track. And I just love seeing that from a character who we mostly think of as the stoic, resolute rebel leader. Here, she's not quite sure that she should even be involved to this degree. I mean, she's not, you know, she's still ideologically aligned with the movement, but she's questioning how involved she wants to be. I just think that that's so cool to see.
Yeah, I really enjoyed her development throughout this whole season and seeing the vulnerability underneath, and also just the lessons that she is learning about the difficult choices of financing and ideologically aligning with a rebellion and the cost that that will have for her personally. One scene that I really loved actually comes in the final episode where she is getting into a fight with her husband in the back of their car, and she is accusing him of gambling. And you know that it's really because she is trying to make an excuse for why all of this money is being moved around in her accounts. And even though it's not like she and her husband have an awesome relationship, things are clearly bad at home, just the way that she is willing to sacrifice that, what little trust is left in that relationship, as well as mortgage her daughter's future, although I'm waiting to see if next season we see if she has a backup plan there in arranging her daughter's marriage. But just the personal toll that it's taking, and the way that even though she is definitely conflicted, she is still pressing forward. And I will just reiterate that her outfits are so great and she looks so great. The fashion's incredible.
It really is. No, just to like go off that point, I think it's interesting that both ways, both avenues that she's sort of sacrificing for the rebellion are throwing her two family members under the bus. Like she's sort of setting her husband up to be under like ISB's like their scrutiny for gambling that he says he didn't do, and that sort of explains the hole in her like books, plus this like child marriage situation. So I'm like, I saw Eric tweeting about this. I'm not convinced that they are actually like for sure getting married, and I know Grace also just said like it, maybe it'll change, but I don't know, like maybe she was sort of relying on that that line in their conversation with Davo where he was like, well, it's just a meeting, like they're just gonna meet, and I don't know, and maybe it gives her enough, like she can blame her daughter a little bit if it does proceed, because the daughter is like super into this weird tradition. But I don't know, I think on both fronts it's interesting that it's again very close to home, the ways that she's decided to like sort of sacrifice for the rebellion.
Well, that's what makes it so interesting too, is that her daughter doesn't seem to resent this. Like for her daughter, this is kind of what was always going to happen, because this is what you do when you're Chandrillon, like, and this is how you respect the traditions. But of course for Mon, she clearly had it in her mind that she was going to tell Lita like, hey, guess what, like marry whoever you want, we're not going to do the tradition thing, I don't want the life for you that I've had to live. And you know, Mon's whole movement is about freedom, individual rights, you know, not having some kind of authoritarian system, over your, you know, hanging over your every move, whether that is political or personal or romantic. And so here's a microcosm of that, where she is, against her own will, having to put those constraints on her daughter that she must have at some point sworn she would never do. And then there's the added layer of, it's not even like painful for her daughter. Like the fact that her daughter wants this and is embracing it must be another gut punch, because it reflects the fact that she's not like longing for that kind of freedom that Mon clearly values so heavily. And so it's just, there's like layers to this. It's not clear cut, like her daughter hates her for this. It's like, she almost, you get the sense, it's like she wishes her daughter hated her for this, because that would at least show that her daughter wanted this freedom, but she's locking herself into the system voluntarily. So it's just a brutal situation. And then, yeah, I mean, she's doing this to two people who are clearly not nice to her, not polite to her, not respectful to her, but the episodes still manage to make you feel bad for them to some degree, because she is using them. And I never thought I'd feel bad for Perrin, but here we are. You know, I don't necessarily know that he deserves this, frankly, but ultimately it's all for the greater good. And, you know, watching her discover that, watching her discover that sometimes you do have to do this, for someone like her with her background and her values, it's just so juicy. It's just, it's exactly the kind of Mon Mothma story that I never knew I wanted.
I think also the show does a good job of demonstrating in different ways how rebellion is difficult and it requires sacrifice and it doesn't always feel noble. It's not clear cut. And we see that with the interpersonal relationships that Mon is sacrificing. We see that with the violence on Ferrix in the last episode, when there is that sort of insurrection in the town square at Marva's funeral. There is a lot of death and destruction, and it's not just the Imperials, but it's regular people who are getting hurt and they're putting their lives on the line and they're dying for it. And then you also see sort of the cold political calculations that Luthen is making with deciding to sacrifice Krieger and his crew. And I think this show does a good job of demonstrating that it's messy. It's not black and white, good guys, bad guys. Even if the cause is noble, even if fighting against tyranny is the right thing to do, it requires sacrifices both on the personal and the community-wide level, which every person has to decide for themselves whether it's worth it. And we see in the first season, everyone who is major player, Cassian, Mon, and Luthen, also I guess to an extent Marva, but all deciding that it is worth it to make this sacrifice of themselves and others. And I think that's really interesting to see.
And, you know, I also have to, you know, shout out Genevieve O'Reilly for just an incredible performance as Mon Mothma in these episodes. You know, you can really see the toll this is all taking on her, both like as subtle as like when she gets into the speeder and she's about to throw Perrin under the bus, she kind of unbuckles her outfit in this kind of opening the collar, like she's sort of getting hot under the collar of like getting nervous or whatever, and sort of, you know, adopting sort of this like, oh, all right, I'm gonna have to do this, oh boy, like I've never kind of done anything like this before. But then also, you know, she's like on the edge of tears when she's sitting there watching Vel and Lita have this conversation, that, you know, Vel is sort of putting on her brave face because she knows what's going to happen, and Mon is sitting there watching them and knows what she's about to have to do to Lita, and like having a hard time keeping it together. And just some really great performances there that make it, you know, bring you perfectly, you know, bring you into this person's world and make you feel the impact of her choices in a way that we don't always see with Star Wars. Even if the choices are very clearly dramatic, we don't always feel it. Well, here we definitely felt it. But, you know, you mentioned Luthen. Let's talk about what he goes through in these episodes, because, as you said, he does demonstrate that he is not sentimental. He is willing to do whatever it takes to move things forward. And even to the point of, like, he has that interaction with Saw, and Saw is clearly very uncomfortable with this and starts to think, well, do you have spies in my ranks? Like, are you going to throw me under the bus too? And he has to sort of talk him down. And it, you know, in that scene, you can see that for Luthen, this is all very delicate, dangerous work, dealing with these feisty personalities, right? Dealing with people like Saw Gerrera, trying to keep the movement together, but having to sort of bring them together in a way that they're not used to. And you just get a sense of his extreme competence and confidence. I'm sure I've said this about him before, but like, it's not just that he's ruthless. It's also that he can see the bigger picture, and he's not shy about doing what it takes to get there. But he also is very cognizant of the fact that he's treading on thin ice with people like Saw. And so he's got to have to balance all that together. Grace, what do you think about kind of the evolution of Luthen that we saw here, or the new sides of him that we saw here? I mean, I guess we could talk about that speech that you alluded to earlier, which is personally, I think, is one of the best pieces of writing that Star Wars has ever had. I won't quote the whole thing, but like, my God, just the depths that he goes to there to illustrate for his ISB mole, like, I've had to give up everything, and I'm not going to get to realize the fruits of my labor. I mean, it's heartbreaking, and it's like, it's gobsmacking. It's just so good.
Yeah, and I think that's also, we have to give the shout out to Stellan Skarsgård, the actor who plays Luthen, for that as well. I mean, side note, all of the acting is freaking incredible. Like, Diego Luna, Andy Serkis, all of it. But I think that it's really interesting to see Luthen. It's like every episode we get more layers peeled from the onion to see what makes him tick. So how much he relies on his assistant, Clea, I believe we get to see in this back third. We get that speech that to the ISB mole about what he has sacrificed to get to this point. And then I really loved seeing him in the final episode, Rick's Road, and sort of seeing him realize that the rebellion is occurring concurrently without his prodding necessarily, but this is an uprising that's built from the community, and he's watching it generate naturally. And you see the kind of excitement on his face, but also perhaps the difficulty of recognizing that real people are getting hurt in a way that you can't tell as much when you are making impersonal calculations. So I really love his character and look forward to seeing where he goes next, and this cat and mouse game with Dedra Miro too, and him as Axis, and where that goes from here.
I felt like an actual child watching the scene where he destroys that tractor beam. Like, the debris, sorry, I know this is not, like, character focused, but
it, no, I'm so glad you brought it up.
The debris, so like, it was so satisfying, and it was just incredibly cool. And when the laser, like, goes out of his ship, and he, like, spins in a circle, like, I don't know, this show was not, like, the most, there were action scenes throughout it, but I think it was more of an ideas kind of show. And but when it did have an action scene, it really delivered. And so I don't know, that's my favorite Luthen scene. I know that's like not big brained of me, because the speech is everyone else's favorite Luthen scene, but I don't know, it just looked really cool.
I'm actually so glad you brought that up, because I had almost forgotten it, and it is so cool, and it really is a moment where you're like, who the heck is this guy? How is he able to fly like that and have this tricked out ship? Like, it does the simultaneous kind of peaking of your interest and curiosity while also being just really freaking awesome in a fun and Star Warsy way.
Well, and it also the payoff of him getting away so easily is heightened by the fact that in the beginning of the scene, you really don't know what's going to happen. I mean, I genuinely thought that might be it for him. Like, they can do whatever they want with almost all of these characters, right? So, like, I thought that could be it for him. Here's this interdictor cruiser, I guess it's an arrestor cruiser, kind of like looming up behind him, this incredible shot, and you're like, oh no, oh no.
Oh, and I love the casual, like, they're like, oh, it's just like a trainer, we should let him go. And he's like, no, what'll be good practice? Like, I love that, like, seeing the bureaucrats during all of this, too.
And it's this tense scramble, right? Because he's trying to get the fake ID ready, then he's trying to, like, prepare to overload the engine, and, like, again, it's like those prison scenes where they're about to transfer the new inmate in and multiple people are talking back and forth and the music comes in and there's just an instability. There's an unease to it. And then, of course, you know, you see that he's known the whole time that he was probably going to be just fine, and he's very smoothly pulling off these maneuvers. It just looks effortless, which, again, is just great payoff because a few minutes earlier you were very worried about him. But, man, I mean, that's just like, as you said, a whole new side of him, like a whole new set of abilities. He's got that composure that never breaks. But I agree with you both that I am so interested to know where this guy came from. I'm sure we're not going to get a backstory for him, at least like his own focused backstory. But like, it just makes you wonder what happened to the guy that brought him to this point.
I also love, like, I don't think we've seen in Star Wars a scene like quite like that with a tractor beam where, like, correct me if I'm wrong, I'm sure someone else has escaped at some point, but like, I feel like when you're going up against a giant Imperial ship like that, it's usually like, oh, you have to be a really good pilot or like really good at aiming things. And he just like blows a bunch of debris out the back of his ship. Like, I don't know. I think it was just a different, like you said, sort of unstable as a scene, and like you have no idea what's gonna happen, and when it does happen, you've never seen that before. So I don't know, I thought it was just extremely creative.
And Tony Gilroy even said, like, when we do action scenes, there need to be a specific hook. Like, there's got to be something special that it's not just, I mean, this was true of the prison set as a whole. Like, if we're going to do a prison, it's got to be a different kind of prison. But he also said that about the action scenes. If we're going to have a fight, there's got to be something unique about it. And you're right. This is the first time I think we can say that we've seen, certainly in canon, getting away from a tractor beam by essentially tricking it into pulling debris into it and blowing itself up. And then that laser beam thing, like,
so cool.
He just, it's so effortless. There's no like sweat on his brow as he's like swerving the ship. It's all just very smooth, almost languid kind of movements, like going past the bridge of the other ship, sort of like the Falcon and Empire getting away from the Star Destroyer, almost taunting them, because he knows that like he's much smaller, but that also means he's much more agile and that he has surprises and that he shouldn't be underestimated. It just really speaks to, again, I will give you, Haley, I don't think it's small-brained of you to say that this was your favorite scene, because this scene actually shows us a lot about his personality and how he acts under pressure, and we haven't seen him, I guess that first scene where he runs away with Cassian, he gets out of Ferrix, but other than that, we don't see him in danger, really, and this is what he does under pressure, and he's a cool boss.
I love a good, like, trickster. Like, he's got something up his sleeve,
yeah.
You know?
Yeah, always. And I will just say one last thing about the laser maneuver. I really love when Star Wars throws out those new kind of ship weapons. And I don't think we've seen anything like the laser before. But just in terms of how satisfying it was, it reminded me of the sonic whatever in Attack of the Clones.
Do the impression. Okay. All right. That's fine.
It needed more enthusiasm.
Yeah. I mean, I was put on the spot. The sonic, what's it called, Eric?
Seismic charge, sonic charge.
Yeah. That thing. But it just reminded me of that because it was so satisfying to just watch it spin and rip the ships apart. And just, I loved it. I do not think it was small-brained of you to say that at all, Haley. I'm glad you brought it up.
Well, thank you.
So, Grace, you mentioned there's this tete-a-tete between Luthen and Dedra, which I really hope we get to see in the foreground of season two. I thought they might confront each other in the finale, but Dedra goes through quite the ringer in these four episodes, from, you know, the high point of, you know, seeing her plan come together, starting to get the resources to carry it out, and being able to proudly tell Partagaz, like, I've got this, it's coming together, we're making this happen. And then she actually gets to Ferrix, and, well, everybody's talked about this to death, but I think we have to talk about it. What was it like having rooted for this character to some degree in some limited way for eight episodes, seeing then in, you know, episode 9 or 10, you know, she, that switch flips, she's in her element, she's in work mode, she's here not just arguing with her colleagues, but now she has real power. And what does she do? She tortures Bix with an audio recording of the screams of dying aliens, with I guess special focus placed on the deaths of the children. Really disturbing stuff. And this is the real Dedra, right? But there's something powerful about giving us a bunch of episodes, I guess like 4 or 5 episodes, where she's the underdog and then reminding us, oh, but she's actually here to do a job, and this is that job.
I think it's important to humanize that kind of villainy, because as we know from the real world, torture is something that is horrific and just so incredibly damaging, both to the person being tortured, but also arguably to the torturer themselves. And I think it's important to show that these people who are conducting this kind of so-called enhanced interrogation are real people, and you can sympathize with them, and you can even understand their motivations. And sometimes I think it's important to see that sort of banality of evil, the way that ordinary people can get caught into a system and choose to rise through the ranks of that system and thrive in that system, and then impose this kind of oppression and horrors on others. So I personally was a big fan of seeing her get into her element of horrible imperial bureaucratic torturer girl boss.
So first of all, I think the torture was like so horrifying, and part of what makes it horrifying is the mystery. Like, I'm so glad, first of all, I'm very glad they didn't like try to play the noise that they were describing for us. But also, like, I think sort of on the note on what you're saying, Grace, I think is important because they almost are asking us the question. I think what's his name? Cyril. Sorry.
The first word that came to your mind was weird.
Weird. See, I think at one point Cyril is like talking to Dedra, and he says, like, is it possible to like justice too much? Like, is it possible to have too much zeal for justice or something like that? And yes, first of all, yes. And I don't know. I think sort of in asking that question and in sort of taking that approach of like humanizing and trying to like show you where like she's coming from before revealing like the depths of evil there, it sort of makes the like viewer ask, like, am I like, I don't want to go down that route in any area of my life. And I know most of us are not like imperial intelligence agents, but there's always like the room to do evil things. And I don't know, I think there's sort of a side effect of examining like, am I like crossing any lines? Am I like, I don't know. And again, this is sort of a stretch because most people will not find themselves in that kind of situation. But a lot of people do very evil things. And I don't know. I think what you're saying, Grace, makes a lot of sense. They're people, and a lot of humans have the capacity for that kind of evil. But I don't know. I will say I found the writing extremely effective, and those scenes were just like horrific.
Yeah. And, you know, talking about kind of how the switch flips for her. I mean, she has this other transformation, right? So she goes from Coruscant, where she's among equals or superiors, to Ferrix, where she's the top dog. She's giving orders to everybody else. They're all, you know, stepping to and obeying her. And she's kind of, you know, she's really the only one who understands the need to take prisoners. You know, everybody wants to charge in after Cassian, and she's like, no, give me 2 guys. like, we need him alive, even calling into that ISB briefing when after they take down Krieger's cell, and they didn't take any prisoners, and she's the only one who cares, and it's kind of like, there goes Dedra again, like, but she gets it in a way that none of them do, and so again, I want to see in season two, I want to see that rewarded with a showdown with Luthen, but anyway, she goes from that to, you know, where she's really in control of herself and her situation, to, you know, when the riot breaks out, and we'll talk more about those scenes later, but she completely loses it, right? She's never been in combat before, clearly. It's definitely not a normal thing for her. She's physically knocked to the ground, you know, emotionally and psychologically knocked off balance, and she starts to panic. This isn't how it was supposed to go. And, you know, Cyril comes to her rescue, of course, and there's that fantastic scene where, you know, she's trying to regain her composure, and she grabs some tool off the shelf, and she's about to hit him, and then she realizes that it's him. And there's, you can sort of see on her face, you know, Denise, I don't know if it's, I think it's Goff is how you pronounce your last name, who plays Dedra, is fantastic in the whole show, as everybody else is, as Grace said. But it, particularly in those scenes where you can see it kind of flits across her face. It goes from like, oh, I cannot believe it's this guy and I owe my life to this guy, to like, well, at least it's somebody that I know and it's not a Ferrix local who's going to try to kill me. I mean, she's really out of it. Like, that is the raw emotion that crosses her face there. And it's, again, and we were talking about earlier, it's great to see this person in multiple dimensions of this person. This is another dimension. This is that raw fear that's underneath all of the composure. So I thought that was brilliant.
I also loved that, and I think it's part of the humanizing of her, because it would be very easy to become destabilized in the midst of that riot. And even though she seems like she's in control, she is part of a system of oppression. And as Nemec says in his manifesto, oppression is the mask of fear. And so I think she's kind of in that moment a microcosm of the empire, where she is powerful and she's in her element until something destabilizes her and you see what's really there underneath, and she becomes just an ordinary person again, because that's what she always was. And I think it kind of reminds me of the scene in the Prison Break episode where, as the prisoners are escaping, you see a bunch of the guards hiding rather than confront the prisoners, including the like main security guy who seemed to really relish prodding prisoners with the electricity stick and turning on the floors. And here he is hiding with all of the other guards rather than confront the uprising that is happening. And I think these are good examples of showing sort of the brittleness of the empire, and especially showing that, giving a human face through her, I thought was very effective.
Let's talk just a minute about Cyril, because this guy, I mean, we were already primed to find him kind of like weird and creepy before this quartet of episodes, but then he turns into a full-on stalker. And you know, Haley, you were talking earlier about that conversation that he has with Dedra. I don't know if it's actually this one or when she's interrogating him, but he meets her outside her office and is like, I basically saying like, I can't stop thinking about you, we need to work together, blah blah blah. And I guess I'm wondering how you read that scene, because obviously there are a lot of people who believe that this is him demonstrating that he has romantic interest in her, that there's some connection on that level, as opposed to just, we both want fascist order and justice. How do you read it? Do you think that that is entering his mind, or is it more just, this is a person who wants what I want in a way that I've really never seen from anybody else, and she can help me achieve it?
I think it's supposed to be just infatuation because of that reason. Like, this is the one true Imperial, right? Like, she's the one defending justice. And so, like, I don't know if it's like sexual so much as I will lay down my life for you. Like I do think it's that, on that level, for sure. I don't know. I think it's supposed to be sort of ambiguous and unnerving.
Yeah, I agree. I think infatuation is a great word for it. And I think to an extent, maybe Cyril doesn't even know what he feels for her, just that he wants to be with her and he wants to defend her because he sees her commitment to quote unquote justice to be as strong as his. And that's why he's so persistent in pursuing her. That's why he saves her life and runs to help her. And I think it is obsession. And maybe it's a little bit romantic, but it's, I sort of interpreted it just as a whole of person obsession with Dedra, that is sort of engaging every bit of his sad, weird little mind. And I think that it's Kyle Soller, I believe, is the actor. He also did a really great job this season of just taking us into the mind of a guy who's basically the narrator of Creep by Radiohead, like just a weirdo, and making you feel for him and understand him, even as you're also going like, ooh, buddy, that's, you're making some choices over there.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing, is that the show mixes all this together, so you're still getting those scenes of him at home where his mom's like listening in on his call and he's like, Mom, go away, I'm talking to my friend, God, Mom, and like apparently snooping through his like belongings. And like, I don't know, there's a great scene where they're sitting at the breakfast table and he literally starts slurping his cereal more loudly just so that he doesn't have to hear her. And it's like, we've all been there, right? That's very relatable. So they continue to weave in those strands of like, ultimately, this is a person who's feeling pressure from a lot of different directions, and a lot of that is from his mom, who's constantly kind of reminding him that he isn't making something of himself. And that is ultimately what drives him to, you know, get the gang back together with Sergeant Mosk, and, you know, take a shuttle to Ferrix to basically just kind of be there. I mean, I thought that was like, there's some sort of troubling real world parallels to people who just show up at events, you know, hoping to get involved in trouble. But like, there's something really powerful about what does it say about them and their motivations and their desire for, again, what you said, Grace, what they perceive as justice, right? They are willing to just go there just in case they're needed, right? And just because they want to see, you know, order be restored, and they expect that that will happen at Marva's funeral. So I think that's great exposition of kind of the mindset of Cyril Karn. And I just love the scene where he and Mosk are on the shuttle and they just switch hats and put their hats on. Like, there's just so much passes between them in that moment, and you just get so much as an audience member understanding that both of them, it's really more, it's not even so much about liking each other as people, it's more like, again, sort of like with him and Dedra, we both want the same thing, and we recognize in each other that we can be partners in this, and there's something strong there. And so even if this whole thing gets shut down by the ISB and Mosk gets relegated to doing whatever he's doing in that like blast furnace or whatever, he still has that thing in his mind where he's like, I gotta be listening for information about Cassian, because hopefully Cyril and I can take this back into the field, right? Like, that's how committed he is. And again, we don't see Imperials like that very often.
Can I say, like, one thing I wanted to see in this season was, and I, like, they didn't really have time, there was lots of plot lines going on, was Cyril sort of, like, being confronted by, like, actual injustice against him or, like, a family member or something that, like, causes him to challenge his worldview. And I think we talked about this in one of our earlier episodes where, like, sometimes you, like, I think it was, we were talking about how he sort of witnesses, like, the Empire not being as committed to like solving this murder or something as he wanted it to be. Like, in those moments he had the decision to like double down or like reconsider, like, you know, his view of the Empire or his view of like policing, and he obviously didn't. But I would love to see him, like, I don't know, I would be interested in seeing him learn about like the prison camps or like know somebody who was caught up in one of those like just really arbitrary sentencings. And like the depressing thing is, just judging by like political discourse today, it's entirely like feasible and plausible for them to write that where he like sort of explains it away, and like even seeing that would be valuable, right? But I just would like to see that kind of confrontation at some point.
Yeah. And if I may, while we're here, just on a slight tangent, could we briefly review the scene on the shuttle where Cyril and Mosk trade caps? What was that about?
So I saw a tweet. It may have been Eric. So Eric, if this was you, like, correct me or like take credit. I saw someone say like his friend knows that Cyril cares about fashion and he thought his hat would go better with his outfit or something.
Oh, that was not me, but I love that. I love that idea that Moss would be so perceptive of Cyril's desires there. That's my new headcanon. Head, do you get it? Headcanon?
Because it did go with his outfit. We get it.
Okay, I just need to make sure that somebody got it.
No, I didn't get it, actually.
So it's
can
a hat.
Can you repeat it? Yeah.
Yeah, so headcanon, but like that also means like on top of your head, also in your head. You know what? I'll explain it after the show's over. Just stick around after the show.
Okay, cool. I need your help.
Yeah, I think that's what that was, is that it was Moss being like, here, try this on. Like, this might work better for your look. If you want to be serving looks on Ferrix, you know,
It worked. Honestly, when I watched it the first time, it worked so much better with his look that I thought that they had, like, traded before that and we were seeing them give each other's hats back. It matched his outfit, so I don't know. I buy that theory.
I want to just go briefly back to the first two episodes here of this quartet, where we are still in the prison. I want to talk just briefly about Kino, because I said earlier I think he has one of the best character progressions of anybody in Star Wars in the course of such a short period of time. He starts out as a person who, as we talked about in our last episode, has a lot of disturbing real-world parallels, including, you know, in the Holocaust, of people who were recruited to basically keep their fellow prisoners in line. And, you know, you understand that, and Andy Serkis has talked about this in interviews, that it's ultimately about him wanting to protect them as much as him wanting to serve his sentence and get released, right? He knows that there's no way to stand up to the Empire, so if he can keep them productive, that means less electrocution for them and more tasty food for them, and that's how he rationalizes it, right? But you start to see him realize, both through Cassian and through his own discoveries and revelations, that it doesn't work the way he thought it did. And that's what ultimately leads him to embrace what, you know, Cassian has been pushing him toward. And the way that Andy Serkis plays this, those little moments where, particularly in episode 10, where he's made the decision that they're going to break out, but he has to kind of keep it together for just a few more minutes and pretend like they're still on program, just the wealth of emotion and thought that crosses his face in those scenes. I can't say enough good things about Andy Serkis. So let's do an Andy Serkis love fest here for just a minute. What are your thoughts on Kino?
I sort of said it earlier and I stand by it. I do think his arc was like the best part of the show. And like when I think about Andor, I think about like him, which I don't think was like the purpose of it. And obviously everyone else did a really good job, but I do think just like the writing was just a cut above for those episodes. And obviously the acting, like he really just did a great job.
Yeah, I also thought it was great, thought Kino was great, loved his whole journey. He had so many great lines, and I thought it was just really fun to watch Andy Serkis in this role. I always love seeing him in live action roles because we're so used to seeing him in mocap roles, which he is also brilliant in, but it's really fun to see him as a person and not a golem or an ape.
Yeah, and you know, it just struck me as I was thinking about him and his role in the show. Andy Serkis has probably had the two Star Wars roles with the most diametrically opposed degree of thought and care and depth in terms of their their character arc, right? Like to go from Snoke to Kino, I mean, my God, I don't know that it's possible to go from a worse written role to a better written role. Truly extraordinary. And by the way, everybody's like, oh, well, he can't swim, so he died. Tony Gilroy did an interview where he was asked what happened to him and will we see him again? And he said, I don't know. I don't know what happened. We didn't see it on screen. So I think he's leaving a door open there that I would find very interesting. I kind of feel like his story works better as it is if it is implied that he was recaptured and killed. But I did find it notable that he said that. So I wanted to bring that up, that he was very deliberate not to say, well, he can't swim, so they probably killed him. No, he didn't say that. So I thought that was very interesting.
I also, since we're talking about side characters that we love, I want to talk about Marva and how great she was, particularly in that final episode with her posthumous speech. I just thought that was a really nice way to have her sort of be the spark that lights this sense of rebellion, and yet another incredible speech. But to me, I thought that the relationship between Cassian and Marva, and to a lesser extent his father, which we also saw a little bit of, I thought that was really part of the heart of the show, to have this sort of familial love be driving him and sort of be the final straw in turning him to rebellion. I just really thought that their relationship was so beautifully done and beautifully acted by Fiona Shaw and Diego Luna. You just really felt the love between them. And I absolutely loved her final speech. I loved that Brasso hit the Imperial in the head with her funeral brick. It's what she would have wanted. So I really appreciated what she brought to the narrative.
Marva would absolutely have been one of those people tweeting, like, you need to punch Nazis. And ultimately, that's what happened, folks. I think it's just beautiful to see the effect that she has on Cassian and the whole community, right? I mean, that speech only does what it does because people love her and they actually feel something when they listen to her say it. Anybody else, it would just be words that they'd never believe, but she's able to inspire them. And you see that, you know, even in the scene where that beginning of episode 11, I guess, right, where you find out that she's died off screen, which I thought was actually surprising to do that way, but ultimately they only have so many minutes in these episodes. And, you know, the daughters of Ferrix are sort of packing up her house. And, you know, that's, again, talk about relatable, right? We've, you know, many people have had to do that, unfortunately, with their own relatives. And it gives you the sense that she didn't have, certainly once Cassian left, and with Clem having died years earlier, she was basically alone there except for B2. And yet she wasn't alone, right? Because she had this support network that wanted to do whatever they could for her. And the show does such a great job without, like, lingering too much on it, of making it clear that that was what was going on and that was there in the background. And it's just very fitting that she plays the role she plays, because it gives you the sense of how important she was to people around her, even if they don't put that on screen.
And I do want to talk about, I'm glad they didn't show her death, because I think it lends itself to sort of this local tradition she sort of hinted at in her speech. And so first of all, on one level, I appreciate that she was able to say all of that, and like that's how she was able to like sort of depart. But like secondly, like the world building in that scene is really interesting, because she's at the beginning of the speech, she's like, I always loved coming here as a little girl and being lifted by the people who had died. And I guess that's referring to like being lifted in wisdom by hearing, you know, their life story or like their departing words. And so they seem to have this really robust tradition of like people who are dying, like record of like a final message, and they like show it to everyone. And so I don't know, like amid all of the chaos of that scene and amid like the very dramatic importance of what she was going on to say, like I appreciated just sort of that little moment of like, you know, like Ferrix is interesting. Like they've been doing this obviously for a long time. And since like a kid, she's been thinking about what she was going to say in her like death speech.
Let's just talk very briefly about Nemec's manifesto. It's great to hear it finally. And I think what he says about kind of the frailty of authoritarianism is so astute and links to so much of what we've seen on the show. I mean, it really is this idea that they're not as powerful as you think they are, and they're only closing their fist tightly to compensate for the fact that this is not natural. I love the way he describes it, that like this is an unnatural state of being, that it's fundamentally natural to be free, and they have to consciously build all these systems and strain to maintain them all the time, because that's not the natural way of things.
I loved that.
Me too. I just, the whole manifesto was so good, and hearing it in his voice too was excellent. And just the earnestness of it, the way that he implores the listener to remember and to try, I think it just really connects to everything that's going on in our own world right now. And I mean, I honestly felt it inspiring. I was inspired by this fake manifesto. So I think that just speaks to how powerful its message is.
Yeah, and it reminds you again that this is not a show about Jedi who can have these high-minded conversations about, you know, do or do not, there is no try. Well, actually, for regular people who don't have the Force, sometimes the best you can do is the best you can do. And that's an important message. And it does get back to what he's saying about somebody will be the breaking point. So just do your best, and that might be you.
And I did love that connection to someday one single thing will happen. It kind of made me think of Luke and destroying the Death Star, and sort of the message that, yeah, there's this farm kid who comes along and exploits a flaw and destroys this giant weapon of doom. But in order to get to that one person who changes things, there had to be so much coming beforehand, and the ordinary people who worked for it. And so I thought that was a good reminder of what it took to get to that point, and made it feel very real and grounded.
Right. I mean, if that's the straw that breaks the camel's back, there had to have been a lot of other straw on the camel's back already. Otherwise, it wouldn't do much. And I really like how that links up to what we see in Rogue One and A New Hope. And of course, you know, he's right. Ultimately, we see the funeral march start to take place. And I love, and Grace, I know you had stuff in our notes too about this, but I love how the music is a metaphor for the rebellion, where as it starts to sound more like a coherent, cohesive musical arrangement and not just people warming up, the Empire starts to get more nervous because they notice that there is this building power, that there is a cohesiveness to it. And for them, the rebels are never more dangerous than when they're actually organized cohesively. That's what they start to see here, and that really freaks them out. And then, of course, you know, we've talked about how great Marva's speech is. The whole scene behind it is wonderful, just because it contrasts what she's saying with Cassian, you know, using the tunnels that she's been scouting to sneak into the hotel and rescue Bix. And, you know, I just can't say enough good things about how astute the writing is there for Marva. It makes you can see in your mind's eye her living on Ferrix all these years, having a sense that something was wrong, but turning away from it, right? And you can see in the crowd that they know she's right, that they recognize that they've been doing this too, that they've been asleep, and that there's no time for that anymore. And so the urgency of it clearly lands with, you know, you see all these people on Ferrix getting ready. They're psyching themselves up for the fight because her words have cut through to them. They realize that she's right. So I just have to shout out Tony Gilroy for masterminding all of this, and you know, the writer of the episode, you know, just for just killing it, just absolutely incredible, one of the best pieces of writing in Star Wars, I'm so glad that was what kicked things off, along with the officer knocking over B2, which is really what got everybody mad and ready to party, because you do not disrespect B2 in this house. But the writing there is just phenomenal.
I do want to say, somewhat tangentially, but since you brought up the music, that the music of Andor was incredible. Nicholas Britell, the composer, just did such beautiful music that also felt very different from a lot of the Star Wars music that we've heard before. But I'm a huge soundtrack fan, and the Andor soundtrack was just really wonderful.
Yeah, and I love that Tony Gilroy had the actual actors playing those musical instruments on set. What an interesting choice, but clearly it came together beautifully, so an inspired choice on his part. And, you know, since we were talking about kind of the messiness and the organic, authentic messiness of some of these fight scenes, I just love when things break out and, you know, it really is ugly. It's not this clean, you know, stormtroopers and rebels shooting each other from across battle lines. Like, it's messy. And when the stormtroopers finally get the, you know, permission to start shooting, I mean, every person who dies, even if you don't know them, you feel that because the sound design and the visual effects and all that, it's gruesome. Like, I think the only person that we know is the owner of the communications shop. Everybody else is just a rando, but all of those deaths land because it's just, it's messy and hectic and scary. And it's hard to make the Empire seem scary these days. This episode definitely did it. All right, so let's wrap things up by talking a little bit about, well, first of all, the post-credit scene. Did you enjoy it? Were you happy that it was there? Obviously, the big reveal here is, yes, in fact, they were building part of the Death Star. Cassian was building the weapon of his own destruction. There's a nice kind of visual parallel with that final shot of the Death Star to the Andor title sequence. I thought it was really cool. If you don't necessarily want to know the answer to that question, you don't have to watch it. It's a post-credit scene. But I thought, again, they made the Death Star scary, which is kind of weird to say that, but it's not always scary in how it's depicted. And they made it terrifying with the TIE fighter sounds in the background and the jarring kind of cuts between closer up to farther away to farther away. I thought it was just like a really great button to put at the end of the season, reminding you where things are headed.
So I agree, and I think it was well done, but I also sort of liked the mystery and the insidiousness of not knowing what specific, you know, military industrial component it was gonna be. So I don't know. I don't know if it was necessary in my view. I feel like it is one of those very few instances where it may have been a little bit ham-fisted. Cause I think it's in our show docs, Andor built the thing that killed him. Like, yes, it's true, but I feel like it's not, I don't know. I don't know if it was, again, I don't know if it was necessary.
I think that's why I'm glad that it was after the credits, because if it had been in the show itself, I think I would agree. But because it was kind of just this 10-second thing that happened after the credits and wasn't part of the show, like Cassian doesn't discover that's what he's been doing, it's just purely for the audience. And I agree with you that I really liked the mystery of it, but I also did like the symbolism. So I think I kind of agree with both of you that, but ultimately I come down to they placed it in the correct place for it to have an impact.
The last thing is I just want to make a couple comments about production design, because these things often get overlooked, but there's some great moments here. In terms of editing, there's a scene where they cut from Bix screaming as she's being tortured to the prison where there's this drill that they're using, and there's a scream from the drill that sounds very similar, and it's like two moments of kind of oppression being linked. There's also another great scene where they cut from Dedra kind of looking out the window to like Luthen standing in his ship, and they're sort of framed the same way, but like one of them is in light, one of them is in darkness. And so the symbolism there I thought was very good. I mean, I could go on and on. You know, at the end of episode 10, you see the overhead of Narkeena 5 and these tiny little white dots of the prisoners getting away. It's not a shot that everybody would think to do to show you what's going on here, but it reframes their escape as the tiny individual, almost ants, escaping from this hulking structure. It reminds you of what they've done and the power of what they've done. So those are just some moments that I thought were really beautifully framed. Ultimately, look, we could talk about these four episodes of Andor for hours. We could talk about each episode for 3 hours, I'm sure. But at a certain point, we just have to say This is, you know, this is Andor season one. This is the season finale, and we're going to have much more to say about the season as a whole and some of the themes throughout the season. But I think this is going to bring our conversation of these episodes to an end.
The final thing I'll just say is that Andor was frickin' awesome. And I, as listeners will know from our episode previewing it, I was very concerned and my expectations were very high. And I am just so impressed by the final product. And I am also very sad that we're not getting new Andor until 2024, because that's a real bummer.
All right, thank you so much for listening to this episode. If you want to share your thoughts about the show, suggest topics for future episodes, you can do that by emailing us at hothtakes@gmail.com, or you can find us on Twitter. We are on Twitter as hothtakes. I'm Eric Geller on Twitter. Grace is Grace_Seegers, and Haley is Birdnator. Speaking of Haley, she made our incredible logo and banner art. I edited this episode, and I also put together our music, although again, as always, for legal purposes, we do want to note all Star Wars themes and sound effects are the intellectual property of Lucasfilm. If you want to listen to past episodes of Hoth Takes, you can find an archive on our website, hothtakes.wordpress.com, and we encourage you, as always, to share this show with a friend or family member. You can do that by finding Hoth Takes on all the major podcasting platforms. That includes Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, and Stitcher. All right, we'll see you next time. May the Force be with you.